Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Question Reality with Priscilla Leona, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you to question your career reality. This show is for you if you are considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guest on the show will help you by providing tips, advice, and resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. And our guests work in various professions and they're at different stages of their careers. So that means that we will definitely have someone on the show who will be able to help you with your show business career questions. If you want to check out our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, go to the LA Talk Radio website, latalkradio.com. Click on the link at the top that says Channel 1. Scroll down, look for the graphic of our show, Question Reality, and click on the link. Now, this takes you to our archive page, directly to the Question Reality radio show archive page, and that is where you can view the list of all of our past guests. Now, people have been asking, how can I get your app? Well, you can download our free app. Never charge for a free app. It's free, so there you go. You can download our free app for your Android and iPhone, and you can listen to any of the other exciting and informative shows too. And you can download that app directly from the home page on the LA Talk website, and that is located. You got to scroll down a little bit. It's towards the bottom of the page. Some people emailed me and said, I can't find it. Well, it's there. It's down the bottom. Scroll your little heart out and get to the bottom of the page. If you want to check us out on iTunes, our shows are available for download as well on iTunes under the podcast section. And we're also on Stitcher.com, which is another wonderful radio show that has a ton of different topics that you can choose from. Just overall great shows on internet radio, just phenomenal. Very exciting that major corporations are contacting us these days, like CBS and NBC, and they're wanting to advertise on internet radio because it is far less expensive than traditional radio, and your advertisement will run indefinitely. As long as we are on the air, your advertisement will be on our radio station forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Okay, so a wonderful reason to advertise on internet radio, no matter what show, whatever fits into your advertisement category, you can advertise. So you can advertise on our show too if you go to questionrealityradioshow.com. Questionrealityradioshow.com. That's our official website. So you can go there and find out how you can advertise on our radio show. Now, I wanted to let you know that we have, by the way, just went to WonderCon yesterday, everybody. I have been hearing for years, WonderCon, Comic-Con, WonderCon, Comic-Con. I said, let me just go and check this out. So it's like a process. For anybody who doesn't know how to get into Comic-Con and WonderCon, first, you got to start with Comic-Con. You have to apply. You can't buy tickets to Comic-Con and WonderCon. You can't just say, hey, I want to buy a ticket. You have to be invited. You have to be like a producer, or you have to be someone in the entertainment industry or broadcasting, and you submit an application to see if you're approved. So, of course, I'm a producer of radio and television and film. So, there you go. I was approved. So, then starts the long, arduous process of trying to get in to get your, well, it's not a ticket per se. You have to get invited to a badge. So you gotta like go at the specific time and you have to sit there and wait, and you're sitting there in the waiting room and you're going, oh my gosh, I want to get invited. So it is a process. I don't even want to tell you it's easy, because it was nerve-wracking. I had to call the doctor and say, I need some pills, because my nerves are just racked up because I didn't get in the first time. So anyway, we finally get to go to WonderCon, and yesterday, it was all this weekend. And I got to tell you, other than meeting Lou Ferrigno and getting to shake his hand and tell him that I'm friends with one of the producers of a show he was cast on, and that being entertaining, I got to tell you, please don't send me emails, because I'm just telling you my opinion. Every time I tell my opinion, I get 672 emails. But I just want to say it was kind of like a big shopping mall. It was just, you know, buy a picture, buy poster, buy this, buy. It's just like a big swap meet, but you pay for things. So maybe an inside marketplace. And of course, if you're into that genre, WonderCon, I guess, is wonderful. I did enjoy the costumes. My God, just some creative, gorgeous costumes that people were really into it. And that was beautiful. I did love meeting Lou Ferrigno. Other than that, I said, my God, you got to bring like a couple paychecks in order to afford the stuff. They had these t-shirts. It was like $40 for a t-shirt. And then I look at the t-shirt and the black from the neck. We were going to buy Albert, my husband, a Star Trek t-shirt. Well, we look at it and the black is faded into the yellow and the red is faded into the black. And Lord knows you don't want to buy a red shirt if you're a Star Trek fan, because they're the first ones to die off. And everybody will comment if you're wearing a red shirt at WonderCon. But Albert wore his blue shirt, which is the science officer shirt. But honestly, the shirts were just so, I'm sorry, but they were really subpar for $40. So keep in mind that you don't have to buy things at WonderCon. Just go for the costumes and go to meet some of the stores. Of course, Lou Ferrigno was selling, I got to say, God bless him. I know he's got to make money, but he was selling a picture. You couldn't even get a picture with Lou Ferrigno unless you forked over $40. Signature's $40. I'm like, Lou, my God, honey, how have you fallen on desperate times? You were just on The Apprentice. What the hell happened? Don't you have money left over from The Apprentice? But that's a whole different story. We will move on. But anyway, WonderCon, don't be too excited. Because unless you're into that genre and you're like a total, you know, into that superhero, I don't want to say nerdy stuff, but, you know, it's like the geeky nerdy stuff, which, you know, I'm all for it. I love my geeks and my nerds, but it's pretty much eat and buy something. So that a lot of people email me, said, how was WonderCon? There you go. That's what happened at WonderCon. But God bless Lou Ferrigno. Okay, so we have an exciting guest on the show today. His name is Kevin Soling. He is the president of Spectacle Films. He's also a writer, a director, a producer, and an artist. And I want you to go to his website now and check it out. It is KevinSoling.com, and that's spelled C. Very unusual way to spell Kevin. I love it. It's very artistic. It's very colorful. It's spelled C-E-V-I-N, S as in Sam, O-L-I-N-G.com. And go to his website. Check it out. You can also reach him on Twitter at Kevin Soling. Just that's it. One word. And I just want to tell you, before we talk to Kevin, I want to tell you something very exciting. Ali Eisenman, Christine Moore, and Puppet, who are the power team behind the controversial, thought-provoking, and in my opinion, sure to be award winners of a ton of short film festivals, with their latest short film. It's entitled Wedlock. Now, if that sound is familiar, it's because the filmmakers were guests on my show February 1st. So if you go to my archive page, you can listen to them just fantastic, entertaining guests. But I'm so happy for them because they just launched the fundraising campaign on the website. And I just discovered this website. I'm telling you, I'm going to tell you what it is now again, because at the time I heard about it when they came on the show, I was not familiar with this website. I'm only familiar with Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and then a couple miscellaneous ones that I get asked to donate. But it's called seedandspark.com. Seedandspark.com. Go there and pull up their page. It's wedlocked. It's seeds. I just type it in. You know how to do it. But this is a fantastic website. I love the way it's laid out there. When you go there, you'll see what I'm talking about. So, for example, if you want to crowdfund for a film, you can break it up. This is, you know, I'm a producer. I produce short films. And the way I approach things when I am asking people for money, when I'm the executive producer, this is a little tip for you people who have not started on the fundraising campaign for your projects. A great way to do it is to say, contact your family and friends first. That's where you're going to go first to get your money. But anyway, you say, okay, I need money for the costume department. Do you want to be in charge of funding the costumes? Do you want to be in charge of funding the makeup? Do you want to be in charge of funding the camera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you need for a film? And the way this website, normally on Indiegogo and Kickstarter, it's not set up like that. They just say, okay, we need this amount of money. Here are your donation perks. Give us some money. And then you go into telling what the film's about, blah, blah, blah. But this website is so methodically set up. They have a camera department. They have the makeup department. They have the costuming department, the grip department, the marketing department. So everything you need money for, it's already laid out. So you just say, this is the amount I need, and it'll say you need 50 people at, say, $50 each. And it's broken down, and then it shows how many people have donated and how many have stuff to go. So it's a fantastic, just really, really tight, well laid out, well thought out website. So if you are trying to get money for a film, I would highly recommend that you bypass Indiegogo and Kickstarter and go right to Seed and Spark, because it will be much easier on you. So check it out. But just to remind you about this film, and then we're going to move on to Kevin. It is a dark comedy short, and it deals with marriage equality through the lens of, are you ready for this, divorce inequality. And it was inspired by actual true stories, and it follows this character, Sydney, and she's forced to make a decision between remaining in a state of a loveless marriage or to move away from her son and a great job that she has to another state that recognizes marriage equality in order to fulfill residency requirements for a divorce. And it's a very important film, thought-provoking. Just the subject matter is very relevant, very now. So if you think so too, please help them get the film made by donating whatever you can afford at the website. Again, seedandspark.com. And you'll be updated frequently on the progress of the film that you're helping to create. And again, if you want to hear these three talented filmmakers, and they give a lot of great career tips and advice on how to pursue your dream job in show business, so go to my archive page, okay? And that is latalkradio.com/Priscilla. Or just type in Question Reality Radio Show on Google. I'm there. You can type my name, Priscilla Leona. I'm there. I'm all over the page. I'm Googled out. They Googled me out. So I highly recommend that. So on to our guest for today. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Kevin. He is the president of Spectacle Films and is involved in the entertainment industry as a writer, a director, a producer, and an artist. And he directed and produced, among the tons of projects that he's worked on, the most recent one that I was familiar with, which is The War on Kids. And this is the winner of the Best Educational Documentary Award at the New York Independent Film and Video Festival. And the film is about, well, it demonstrates how American public schools have become modeled after prisons in response to fear and just a burgeoning intolerance of youth. And it's currently, it's on the documentary channel. I think currently it is still airing on the documentary channel. And it has received accolades from the New York Times, Variety, the Huffington Post, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in addition, the film was featured on national television, along with an interview on the Dr. Nancy show on MSNBC. And Kevin was also the featured guest on the Colbert Report. And that's exciting. I mean, I have not had a guest on the Colbert Report yet, so this is a first. He was also the executive producer of the independent feature. And you know I love this title. You know how I am, people. If you follow my show, you know I'm going to love this title. Relax. It's Just Sex. And that stars one of my favorite actresses. I loved her back in the day, Jennifer Tilly, Lori Petty, and Cinda Williams. And it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and it was also seen on HBO and Showtime. So that's huge to have your show on HBO and Showtime. Or as they say in Jersey, it's huge. Huge it is. So this guy is just a phenomenal talent. I couldn't even, it would take the whole show for me to tell you all the projects that he has worked on or is working on. So lastly, he has a ton of other projects, as I just said, and they've either been produced, they're in production and development. So go to his website, kevinsoling.com, C-E-V-I-N-S-O-L-I-N-G, because he has a phenomenal career. So, my God, let's get started with him. Kevin, what is going on?
That's a rather broad question, but I really appreciate the introduction. That's going to be hard to live up to.
Well, it most certainly is not, because you are such an impressive, talented individual. I would say that you're probably just a little angel put on this earth to bring out thought-provoking topics and bring them to life. Now, what I want to ask you is, what did you want to do or be when you were a child? When little Kevin Soling was running around, what did he see himself doing or being? Has it always been film, or did you want to be like a fireman or a doctor? What was going on as a child?
I probably wanted to be a Bond villain, I think. I didn't go to film school. That just kind of happened. I think I probably still want to be a Bond villain, so I don't think that's necessary.
Well, who doesn't? Who doesn't want to look like a Bond villain's hot chick coming out of the water? Of course, we all want to be James Bond or the hot chick.
I wanted to be the villain. I wanted to be the one with the death ray who makes the demands to the United Nations, you know, that they cede world control over to me.
And have a cat or some sort of animal on your lap. Okay.
Yeah, the cat. Let's go with the cat.
The cat works. Yeah. Now, what is it about being a filmmaker that makes you feel that this is definitely the career for you?
I do have a revolutionary spirit, and it's basically trying to find what the most what medium, I guess, has the greatest revolutionary potential. And there are fewer and fewer people who read these days, so it's hard to grab that kind of imagination and inspire people to instill change in the world with some of the other mediums. And for the time being, film seems to be the one that's most salient as far as those possibilities. So that for me is what has drawn me to film.
Well, I want to talk about, because my husband is a huge Beatles fan, like phenomenal Beatles. They're it. They're the sun, the moon, and the stars above. And I know that, as far as my information is concerned, that you are currently in the treatment stage of a documentary television series about the Beatles entitled Revolution and Beyond. And I understand that the series is going to the series studies the revolutionary acts of the Beatles as purveyors of social change and championing,
I guess,
just being instrumental players.
And it's, It's actually in the production stage, and it's transformed from being a series into a doc, you know, a feature length documentary film project. And I've been driving and, you know, traveling, flying all over the country, interviewing people. there are several that I'd wanted to interview who regrettably and very sadly passed away, and this all seems to be happening over the last few months, so I'm really feel like I'm at a race against time right now. But the film deals largely with the Beatles' involvement in supporting the civil rights movement, which is something that's little known as far as their activism there. They had one clause in their contract when they toured, and that was that they would not stay, you know, play in front of a segregated audience. And this is something, you know, very few people know. And that was the totality of their contract rider. And they also refused to stay at segregated hotels, and this caused conflict in some of the places where they played. And I, you know, part of the thesis of the film is that in the backlash in 1966, when records were being burned and there were radio stations boycotting the Beatles over, you know, presumably over what John Lennon had said when he made the comment about the Beatles being more popular than Jesus, that it was actually inspired in part by the resentment of the Beatles' cultural change and their championing of you know, civil rights.
Well, we obviously this is what the movie is about. But what do you hope in your version? What is the most important message within the movie going to be, according to your vision?
I guess it's about revisiting history and looking at this event that has been, you know, largely misinterpreted as being an expression of some kind of hubris, to better appreciate what actually transpired at that moment in time, to also appreciate the moral integrity of the Beatles and sort of be a driving force for other artists to understand and appreciate that you know the weight of history the necessity of the Beatles being appreciated and respected for this, I think shines a light for other artists to you know, to take a moral stance on issues, even when there might be possible, you know, dangerous reactions to that, and that being on the right side of history is, and being standing for these progressive causes is necessary.
Your recent film, which I got a copy of and watched, I thought it was fantastic, wonderful, just really thought-provoking as far as my husband and I are concerned, The War on Kids. Now, the description of that says that the film demonstrates how American public schools have become modeled after prisons in response to fear and a burgeoning intolerance of youth. Can you explain your viewpoint? Is it a study? Is it based on a study, or is this just your viewpoint?
Well, I spent 8 years making that movie, and I became radicalized in the process of making the movie. I mean, I went through the public school system, and I, you know, thought it had, you know, great problems, certainly. And that's one of the things that there's, you know, rare bipartisan agreement is this necessity for, you know, for reforming and fixing our schools. And there is objective evidence, certainly, in the poor outcomes that result from compulsory education, and that's just people looking at the things that they presume schools are designed for in terms of, you know, literacy. But there are all sorts of other adverse outcomes that aren't even measured or people don't even look at, and that's sort of what I was ended up, you know, uncovering. Basically, youth has become pathologized, and you have, I think, roughly 3 million people now who are being drugged. And the reason they're being given these drugs is just so that they can adapt to the environment, that it's the environment of schooling that's so toxic. It's not, you know, there's no species that you can put in captivity that where there aren't that doesn't result in stress. And when psychologists do these kinds of experiments on animals, they know that that this is a factor. Well, when you put children in, you know, where they're forced by law to be in a an environment where they're deprived of all power, there are adverse consequences too. And you know, the fundamental message of film is obedience to authority, and it results in the very problems that school pretends that it wants to fix. It creates the environment, you know, is a catalyst for bullying. The environment is responsible for people becoming anti-intellectual and for the ridiculously low literacy rates. It's also responsible for a decrease in empathy, which is one of the most depressing outcomes. And there was research about that by a man named Irvin Staub. So it's a toxic environment, and it can't be reformed, and it needs to be replaced with other methods that are more constructive and are devoted to dealing with people as individuals with different needs.
What if you had the opportunity to come up with a syllabus on how to correct these problems in our school system, specifically focusing on the bullying? What would be some of the things that or methods you would incorporate to change it? Because it is rampant. It is crazy. I mean, everybody's familiar with the recent YouTube video of the brother and sister walking through the park, and then to get street cred, this girl jumps the brother and the sister and beats the girl to a pulp right in front of her brother. And when her little brother, who's maybe 5 or 6, jumps in, she just knocks him to the ground. Well, what bullying? This is to get street cred now, which I just can't. I mean, I can't even fathom why people would do that. But what methods or what ideas would you come up with to change the way
first and foremost, people need to realize and appreciate that the worst, by and far worst bullies in schools are the teachers and administrators. And the students then just replicate the experience that they have of being held powerless. People need to experience and feel some kind of power over themselves, over their lives, and have some degree of control. And by bullying others, it's the only way they get to experience it, and it's the way that's tolerated and accepted in that kind of environment. Or it's done in secretive, you know, outside the margins. But it comes, you know, at least in large part, you know, the biggest catalyst, you know, comes from being held, you know, deprived of any power and control over their lives. And then it's magnified because they are then forced to associate with people that they don't like. So again, it's the environment is something that's never considered. So all of the efforts to deal with bullying are disingenuous, dishonest, or just outright ignorant, because they always avoid dealing with the environment. They're generally about conditioning people to accept the environment and be good and, you know, to one another, in spite of the fact that they are held captive. So it's wholly destructive, all of the approaches, and they're all basically scams. So if you want to deal with bullying, you need to take people out of that kind of environment. And that's not a solution that people want to hear, but it's the honest one. And it's also why people in their gut know that the anti-bullying efforts are always, you know, doomed to fail.
School scores are so low in this country, it's embarrassing compared to other parts of the world. Is bullying, which is one of the main factors, children can't focus in school and have low grades, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are foreign countries less prone to kids bullying in school? And if so, why? And why are
there
scores higher?
No, I don't think they're less prone. And I question the deviations in the tests. If you have that kind of environment, it's going to, and most other countries, you know, have basically, it was the American system was modeled after one that was invented in Prussia that was designed to create obedient soldiers. And then everyone, because of Americans' economic success, everyone then picked up on you know, has replicated our system in varying degrees. And generally, when you have a hierarchical power structure, it's you know, even forgetting, you know, the bullying and bullying, you know, yeah, we'll always emerge in that kind of environment by and large, but it can become less prominent when the societies are more homogeneous. So, you know, there's certainly that issue in the United States that the school is, you know, has become more heterogeneous, and bullying can become exacerbated to a certain degree because of that. But it's, you know, the depressing, you know, results in schools, and you can find whatever school system, I think Finland or something that might be, you know, currently at the top this, you know, this week. The scores, if you consider that you're placing someone in this environment for, you know, 7-8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 10 months a year for 13 years, the results theoretically would be better or should be better, and even in, you know, the best of those. And the reason it isn't is because, again, people, the kids, it's not a healthy environment to learn. You know, people are learning in an abstract way; they're not learning by actually participating or doing or in a way that's even relevant to them. And it's not, and most importantly, it's not self-directed learning. They're not getting to explore things that they are fundamentally interested in.
Right. Now, you are involved in, it's actually mind-boggling to me. I thought when I looked at your press kit, I said, how does this man focus on so many different topics and subjects and actually make these projects, which usually, you know, if you like comedy, you make comedy films. If you like drama, you do drama, or horror, and it's very specific. But you, based on what I've seen, you cover so many different topics. For example, you have a recently completed documentary called Ikhlin, which, to my understanding, is a documentary on a lost tribe in northern Uganda who had been described by anthropologists who studied them as being the worst people in the world. And I thought, wow, to go from the Beatles and then the war on kids to this type of documentary, how does this man do it? It's amazing. But I found the subject matter interesting. Was there really a lost tribe in northern Uganda? And, you know, what was that about?
Yes, so there was a tribe that had been studied by this anthropologist in the 1960s. And I guess there had been some missionaries that had seen, you know, that have seen them since then. So, I mean, when you say lost, it's lost in the sense that there had been nothing in the popular literature, and I guess there were some German linguists that had been out there in the 70s. But this anthropologist studied them in the 60s and really came to thoroughly despise them. And he wrote this book that came out in 1972. I don't know why it came out so much later than when he visited them, but he just vilified them, and the book sent all these shockwaves at the time, because there had been, you know, sort of the philosophy of the 60s was that capitalism is this corrupting force, and if you remove, you know, capitalism, that man by his nature is good. And here he described this tribe that would that where there was no love between the people, there was no joy, that the only time they ever, you know, had any kind of amusement was at the misfortune of one another, and their sole source of recreation was schadenfreude. So they would do things apparently like defecating in front of one another's huts for the sheer pleasure of making each other miserable. So I thought this would be just an amazing place to go, because either this would be cinematic gold if they were, you know, really as wretched and horrible as described, or I'd have the opportunity to redeem the reputation of these people that he had thoroughly trashed in his book. And they had been lost in the sense that no one had ever really done any work that had been, you know, come out on any significant way, or any, certainly no film had existed, you know, since he had been there.
But to describe them as
a harrowing journey, yeah.
But to describe them as being the worst people in the world. That's a really definitive statement. I mean, you got to be able to back that up. What was he saying that would be
the definition
of the worst?
Well, he recommended, and this is coming from, this anthropologist, he was the curator of African ethnology at the Museum of Natural History. He had a PhD from Oxford. He was a highly respected man named Colin Turnbull. He actually recommended that the tribe be broken up so that, you know, then dispersed throughout Uganda so that their culture would be annihilated. He just thought their culture was so depraved and perverse that there was, you know, like I said, no love among the people. Children would steal food from the elderly. Parents would starve their children to death, and things of that nature he allegedly witnessed.
Did you witness this when you went there? Was this any of it true?
I witnessed a lot of horrible things in Uganda on my way up that will forever scar my memory. But those people were wonderful and nice, and that was the one, not the only oasis, but it was certainly a happy respite among a journey of terrible horrors of getting to witness things of LRA atrocities and things, you know, there's warrior tribes, the Turkana, who indiscriminately slaughter people. It was pretty harrowing trip.
But yeah.
and
oh,
bandits.
My gosh.
I
bet that's definitely an intense trip. I had a friend who runs a charity in Uganda, and the things that she says that these poor children go through, it's heart-wrenching. Now you, this might be in final production now or post-production, you did a documentary on the Satanic Temple. Again, another just completely removed from the last two, the Satanic documentary on the political activities of a satanic organization. I would be scared to death to even encroach on that subject, and you just dove right in. So what was it? It was called The Satanic Temple. What was it about, and what did you have to do to get this documentary done?
Oh, well, that one's still ongoing. So that's an ongoing project. The Satanic Temple, they're a political activist organization that does they champion various things such as religious plurality. I guess one of their most famous efforts, which was also featured on Colbert, was they offered to donate a 8.5 foot tall solid bronze statue of Baphomet, this goat headed demon, to Oklahoma City, where they have a Ten Commandments statue, because the Establishment Clause says that the city either has to remove the Ten Commandments, they can't sponsor religion, or they have to be open to all religions. So that was one thing they did. There's an ongoing legal battle there now over that. They've championed women's reproductive issues and using Hobby Lobby, saying that that women aren't under their religious tenets, that women don't have to be subjected to various state restrictions because they can invoke religious defense to a bunch of the state restrictions that are placed on their reproductive rights. They're using religion to protect children from corporal punishment that violates their beliefs about the inviolability of the body and mind. Under their brand of Satanism, they're using to defend and protect and advance rights. So they have a very progressive agenda. And I guess one of the more amusing things they did was they went to the grave site of the mother of Fred Phelps, the head of the Westboro Baptist, and they performed a ceremony called the Pink Mass that turned her gay in the afterlife. They engaged in some wonderful, you know.
Oh my God! Stop it! Well, you know, what are you going to do? You got to be open to everything in the entertainment industry. You can't be judgy. The last project I want to talk about, I think it's in post-production now. Love the title. This is as far, as deep as I go here on this one. The Gilligan Manifesto. And it's a documentary on how during the height of the Cold War, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, how one of the popular programs on television depicts seven Americans in a post-apocalyptic world where they form a communist society. Now, I am a film and television maniac, and I do not remember this show at all. What was the name of it? And for real? Like, tell us about it.
The show is Gilligan's Island.
Oh, you're talking about Gilligan's Island. What? Oh, I didn't associate.
So Gilligan's Island aired from 1964 to 66, 3 years. One year right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, when the tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union were certainly at their peak, and it seemed as if, you know, we were going to come to nuclear, you know, war, and you, this was certainly on the consciousness, the mass consciousness. People had their fallout shelters. The whole thought of having to, you know, start from scratch and rebuild civilization is, you know, was something that was actively discussed. And this show depicted precisely that. You had seven people stranded on an island that was certainly a metaphor for you know, this nuclear apocalypse that they had to, you know, reconstruct society. But what's fascinating is that the society they build is pure communist, and not only is it pure communist, but the conflicts in most of the episode is that some vestige of democratic capitalism rears its ugly head and has to be excised by the end of the episode for stability and communism to prevail.
Have never, ever, ever in all of my film groups or hanging out with film people, filmophiles, never has Gilligan's Island been described as a show about post-apocalyptic world that forms a communist society. I love the thought. I am going to take that and use that thought with my next group to discuss, and we're probably going to wait for the Gilligan Manifesto to come out so we can see it. We're going to all flock to it, but never would I have associated that with Gilligan's Island, and I think that's brilliant. Yeah. I think it's brilliant. Now that you describe it, it is pure genius. I never got that, yeah, but I totally see it now. I totally see it!
Yeah.
Wow.
But most people don't appreciate it, a product of its time. And it was funny, when I was telling people about it, they thought that the show was filmed much later. So it's when you place things, you know, in their context and in their time, that you can, you know, start to appreciate some of these things.
Well, it is very, now you have, I'm sure all of my listeners, I'd say half, maybe 75% would never have seen Gilligan's Island in that light. So you have definitely opened up a can of worms for discussion about what that show is about. I can't wait to tell everybody about your film in production. When can we expect this to be released, and where can we see this? Because I am first in line. I'm going to beat everybody up just to get to be the first.
Well, it's in post-production now. I expect it will be completed this year. As far as where it ends up, I've been in the fortunate position where I make my movies first and then shop them later, although I guess the Beatles one is going to be an exception to that. But in general, I make the stuff first, so I'm answerable to no one in the process, in the creative process. And then, you know, find a home for them. And I've been, you know, pretty fortunate that I've been successful at that.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's one of my next questions that I wrote out for you. Because in my personal experience dealing with filmmakers, usually they have 1 to 3 projects going on per year, and honestly are lucky if they get one project funded in a year. And I look at you and what's going on, like I couldn't even include all of the rest of the projects. The list just went on and on and on. You have a ton of projects from the past, the present, and the future, some going on at the same time. And just overall, we need to know this, because when I posted that you were coming on and people looked you up, they wanted to know how the hell you're getting all these films funded and what your secret is, because this is just, it's virtually impossible. Unless you were born with a silver spoon and you have tons of money, or you're like a day trader or a stockbroker, where are you getting the money? We need to know, because we want to get more film made like you do. What's the secret?
That I don't have an answer for. I mean, basically, the first film I made, I mean, everything is, you know, it's done on credit cards and everything, and it was a documentary called A Hole in the Head, and it was dealing with the riddle of why Neolithic man was cutting holes in their heads, and they know that they survived drilling the holes. And so this one doctor had come up with a theory as for why it was being done, and tested it by drilling a hole in his own head. But so anyway, I followed all this, and I made this documentary about this, you know, as well as this possible answer to this archaeological riddle. And it ended up becoming this cult, you know, favorite, and aired on the Discovery Channel and Learning Channel, and that was back in the days when they paid for movies. It was only a few years after that the market became, you know, flush with filmmakers. But by then, I was fortunate enough to have established a name for myself. So generally, you know, it's documentaries, and it doesn't make a huge amount of money, but it can make enough to cover itself, and, you know, and then you can just recycle the money into the next project. I've kind of overextended myself at the moment, because I've been working on three or four projects at the same time right now. I just finished one that you didn't mention, about this tribe in the South Pacific that worships America, a cargo cult. And I'm in production on the Beatles one. I'm in post-production on Gilligan. I have a pilot for a TV series. So the Beatles one,
where
I'm reaching out and trying to get funding
from. We want to know your secret. I mean, everybody can do their project if they had money, but how?
Yeah, well, you know, I bet I don't. You know, the answer is you just, you know, I
not you. You don't necessarily have to tap.
I kind of have to let it slow me down. If I can't go in production, then I work on editing on a different film until I can work out, you know, some arrangement with funds. But I'm not sitting on.
What would you suggest? I mean, as an executive producer or producer, the money seeker, what to give advice to someone who wants to do what you do, who wants to become a documentary filmmaker, but they're poor. They want to do it, but they're held up by a lack of where to get money. What advice can you give them?
I'm frequently held up by that too, as well. But it's not. But I don't let it hold me up. I mean, I guess that's really the advice, is that there are plenty of people out there who are willing to do favors. There's quid pro quo. There are things. I guess a lot of times where I get favors with where I can film certain things or get discounts on airfare or free airfare is I've given footage to the airlines or whoever I'm working with. It's just a process of constantly making deals with everyone. And then if you've got a camera, you can usually, you know, trade the footage that you're, you know, just spend a few extra hours filming something that has, you know, that is value for some of the people that you're trying to, you know, cover expenses for. And that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, that we do all the time. I do all the time. And in Vanuatu, I guess, to get, you know, there's a lot of, you know, equipment we were trying to transport, and we could only use, you know, this tiny charter plane because we're going through this tiny island. There's an active volcano, and I brought one of the drones, the copters, and got some footage over the volcano and gave that to the Department of Tourism and the airline. And, you know, it's just a matter of being creative and cutting deals and offering, footage of things that you are doing otherwise anyway. And just, you know, maybe putting in a few extra hours, but it's really just a matter of, you know,
That's it. There. Okay. So basically, people, the message on how to get more money, and I think that's a brilliant idea. If you're shooting something, if you're on a certain location, shoot some extra footage and go, as he said, to the Department of Tourism. Make it really good, edit it, make it professional, go to the Department of Tourism, try to sell it to them. Or maybe if you catch someone in the shot, try to sell it to them as a part of a commercial. That is very creative. Absolutely, to get some money back. Very creative. So there you go. Our time, believe it or not, is over. And it has been a fascinating interview, as you are a fascinating man. And I'm sure we're going to see you walking down the red carpet to get an Oscar for one of these wild documentaries. But if you want to check out Kevin and see what's going on, go to his website, kevinsoling.com, kevinsoling.com. We are so looking forward to this, as I am, at least, the Gilligan Manifesto. So if you go to his website, I'm sure he has everything on there about his past projects, which I tell you, we couldn't even cover, couldn't even begin to cover all of the things that he has done. And I personally have seen his documentary, The War on Kids, and it is really, really good. So if you are into documentaries and you appreciate good topics and the way they're captured and told in a very, I feel personally, I can say this, a very democratic way, open to lots of different viewpoints, then you want to check out Kevin Soling and become a fan. I assume, yes, you are on Twitter. So follow him on Twitter. His Twitter address is @KevinSoling. So go there and follow him, and I'm sure he will take you on a fascinating journey, as he has done with us today. All right. Well, I want you to say last words to your fans. I want you to say goodbye to your fans. Kevin.
Well, thank you, fans. And one of the downsides of doing all these projects is that I've been negligent in updating my website, but so it might be a little behind. But I do send original thanks for my different projects, but I really have to update my homepage.
Yes, you do. You got to keep everybody. People want to follow you. They want to be your fans. You got to let them know what's going on. All right. So we're looking forward to his documentary on Revolution and Beyond. If you're a Beatles fan, there you go. Something for you. If you're interested in foreign topics, we've got Iklan about the lost tribe of North Uganda. I want to see that one, too. I want to find out more about the worst of the world, the documentary The Satanic Temple. I'm not going to go anywhere near that, but I'm sure there's an audience out there. And then lastly, the one I am most looking forward to, The Gilligan Manifesto. So follow Kevin Soling and he will take you on a journey, and Lord knows what he's going to get next. I don't know. You're going to have to come back on the show next year so we can find out what you've done this whole year, because I'm sure you're going to do like 10 or 20 more documentaries this year. And,
well, I've got the book out too, the Student Resistance Handbook, and then it's gone from He Will Come.
Okay, all right. Now, see, you better get that on the website and let people know where they can buy it. I imagine they can go to Amazon, right?
Well, that one just was completed, so it'll be shopped shortly.
Okay, which one? Can we buy any of your books on Amazon, or...
Oh, yeah, the book's on Amazon, the films are on Amazon, the Student Resistance Handbook is on Amazon, and War on Kids, and Ipland, and Hole in the Head, and others.
Perfect. Perfect. Kevin Soling on Amazon. Go there now. Thank you so much, Kevin. Thank everybody for tuning in, and we'll see you next week on Question Reality. Say goodbye.
Thank you so much, and goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
You're listening to Question Reality with Priscilla Leona, right here on LA Talk Radio.